Accession number 27185, Reel 3.
Major Barras, Reel 3. I think you were saying that when you were sent off to Gold Ammunition Train, you were given an impressed account.
Yes. Which had a registered number, so I could go to any field cashier I could find and get and draw some money. But I wasn't to come back to the battalion for 2 months. So I don't recollect ever being told why the ammunition train needed guarding or where it was going. I didn't even know where we were going. We set off on the French railways. And the first thing that comes to mind is when we got to Rouen. We lived in coaches. There were about, I suppose, a dozen wagons with ammunition in them. I don't know, they were all sealed. I believe there were some aerial bombs in some of them, I was told. But we lived in passenger coaches and slept on the seats.
Well, attached to the train?
Attached to the train, yeah. And when we were approaching Rion, there was a hell of a jolt, and a thing stopped and shuddered. And I got out and walked up, and there was this great big French steam engine lying on its side. What had happened, I don't know, but the engine driver was standing there, seemed totally unconcerned about the thing, leaning up against a wheel, one of the big wheels, which was now sort of lying parallel to the ground with a Gauloise stuck in his mouth. Apparently he'd gone to sleep. He was quite happy telling everybody, "Oh, oui, j'adore, j'adore," he said. So that was the first incident we had. I think we must have been shunted off and put on another locomotive. The next thing we finished up, we stopped in Amiens and stayed there for 3 or 4 nights. But we were just next to the marshalling yards, I remember. And there was a big sort of signal box thing there where they controlled these trucks. What they used to do was drive these trucks up a hump. They were undone, push them over the side, they go down the other side, and then they'd be put into whatever siding they were trying to make up a train. And there was a large speaker from the signal box, and he used to shout out the numbers, and the chaps down there used to pull the levers. But they spent the whole night arguing, and it was so difficult to get to sleep when we first got there, because what was happening, because chaps on the ground would shout back at him in French or something, he'd done something wrong. But of course the bloke in the signal box had the big hand, because he got this loudspeaker outside and used to blare them out, and they used to spend the night shouting and screaming at one another. But I think we got used to it, and after about a couple of nights, we managed to get some sleep.
What were you supposed to do? I mean, there were about 20 of you. You were a sergeant, 2 corporals,
yes,
and your soldiers. Did you have to deploy a guard around the ammunition train?
Yeah, night? Every time we stopped.
Every time you stopped?
I used to put guards out. And then and that was the only time we really got to make any food too. Actually, we used to get down the road, the side of the rails there, get the old cooker going, and quick as we could, and try and get something down before the train moved on again. But eventually, we finished up at a little village called Fortel in the north of France. Little village with us, and we pushed into the siding, and there we stayed. And I gathered that the idea of these ammunition trains was that when the balloon went up and the BEF and the French First Army, I think, went into Belgium, these trains followed on behind and made dumps.
So they were destined to go forward into Belgium.
That's right.
And to provide you with ammunition stocks.
Dump the stuff in Belgium, so that it was going to get forward stocks there, yes. But we were so long in this place that I had to do something. I mean, we'd been there for a few days, I suppose.
How are you getting on about getting supplies of food? Because
well, what happened was that I used to go up. There was a little estaminet there in the square where the chaps used to go and get their drinks. I hired a room at the back there, which we used for ourselves, and I got a bath and put a curtain up, and we had that in one corner. We had another bloke mending shoes in another corner, and then we had the stove, of course, and there was a table with chairs around it. So we used to use that. And then the proprietor of the estaminet had a taxi, and I used to go off with this bloke I think I must have, I did find the field cashier somewhere. I mean, we were miles away from the main body of the BEF. I found a field cashier somewhere, I got some money. And I used to hire this taxi, and we used to go off to the nearest town, and I used to go shopping. And he'd go in the nearest bar with his buddies there. I'd have a rum, cafe rum, which was the thing in those days when it was cold, and go off and shopping. And quite often when I got back, he was drunk. So what used to happen is I used to have to get him in the back of the taxi, lay him on the back seat, and drive the thing back myself without a license, and get back. And of course his wife she didn't like him going off in his jobs because she knew exactly what was going to happen. And when he got back, she gave him a pretty good earful in French. Luckily I didn't understand him. He was far gone to understand it either. But I gathered later that this guy had liver trouble, like so many of the French did in those days, and he died quite early. But if I'd known, I'd have probably tried to use my influence, stop him drinking. I don't suppose it would have much effect.
So you were, in effect, you were living on the civilian economy.
Yes.
Buying food and so on. And
yes.
Who did the cooking for you? Did the estaminet do that for
no,
you?
No, we did our own cooking. Right. We had a stove at the back. I found a couple of blokes who, I don't know whether they were volunteered cooking. There was Corporal Melbourne, I remember, who later went to the mortars, who could cook well. He knew cooking.
Yes.
And he got another bloke and two or three of them sort of trained to it. We had to look after ourselves entirely.
So what did you do eventually? You said you eventually concluded you've got to do something about it.
Well, this is what I did.
Yes.
Eventually, when it got cold, because we got no blankets or anything, I had to get this taxi and go and find a battalion.
How did you go about doing that?
Well, I don't know how. I must have got the information from one of the field cashiers, because they're the only people I had any contact with in the army at that time. And of course they were right over near Lille. They'd gone up to the north there, where most of the BEF were then stationed.
But you had no means of keeping in touch with them?
None at all.
No.
None at all. We got no mail.
Yes.
And so I got in this taxi with this bloke. He happened to be sober at that time, fortunately. And we found the battalion, and everybody said, oh gosh, we thought you were lost, you know. Anyway, I had a meal in the mess. I then collected all the mail, which had piled up for everybody, collected blankets for everybody, and then drove back to a lot of grateful soldiers who were going to got their mail and were going to be warmer at nights.
Who was supposed to be giving you your orders at that time?
I'm not sure. I never found out.
So you you've been told to go and guard the train, but
yes.
Was that by the company commander or by the battalion commander?
I think it was the CO who actually sent for me at that stage and told me
put
about
you on
it.
This detached.
For 48 hours.
And that went on to
2 months.
2 months.
Two
months.
Yeah. I didn't get back to the battalion again until the end of November. So I got a football, I think, when I was with the battalion and took that back, and we used to play in the local village at football. And then I got to here, there was another ammunition train in the station just down below us from the 1st Wiltshires. Remember his name now, Jewell, 2nd Lieutenant Jewell. So we used to play football against each other. They used to come up and play football against us, and we used to go down then. And I used to use the railway telephone to call him every day and see how he was getting on and how I was getting on.
Was he in a similar situation?
Yes, exactly, yeah. There must have been others, but he happened to be the nearest one, so we just made contact. I don't know how I got there. I suppose the station master told me. I got quite friendly with him. He used to keep on, every time I saw him, he used to tell me how in the La Guerre 14-18 he had a mitrailleuse, you know, and he used to go tack, tack, tack at me. But there was another station master there who came in another station. I think he took over this gap. It was a bit more sinister looking. And the villagers didn't like him very much. And later, after the breakout from Normandy, when I was still with the 2nd Essex then, I happened to be passing Fortell Village and peeled off and went to see them again. And they said, oh, yeah, that station master was a spy for the Germans.
Fifth columnist?
Yeah, fifth columnist. Mm-hmm. And he was put inside. I think he was shot. Someone shot him.
Where was Fortell? What was the nearest town of any size to it? You went through Amiens on your way up.
Yes, we went through Amiens. Abbeville. I can't remember. It was in the top left-hand corner, I know. Mm. Well, not so far as Calais, but I mean, the Lille was over here.
To the right.
To the right, and we were somewhere here. Yes. Calais was there. Amiens, Abbeville, this little place here where we saw about two little puffer trains a day.
Did the soldiers get bored or fed up being...
No, I think they rather liked it. I mean, they were very good. I didn't have any disciplinary... I mean, I couldn't give anybody CB. I couldn't do anything. I mean, I had a sergeant there. I remember Sergeant Ward, Darkie Ward, he was called. All wards were called Darkie. I never knew why. Who was a champion boxer. So perhaps they had a little bit of respect for him. But yeah, I know he never had to use his fists at all. I think they rather enjoyed it. They were away from the RSM's eagle eye. They were away from normal battalion disciplines. They behaved themselves very well. They did their guards. I had to muck in, so to speak. I mean, they knew I was still the boss and took the decisions at the end of the day. But we had our meals together. I used to sit down at the head of the table and the troops just sit round this table, and we had our dinner together. They never took advantage of it.
How do you have the guards organised? How many men do you have on guard at any time normally?
I think there were four.
So it's four men on guard.
Two men together patrolling. Of course, they were patrolling. They used to wear, of course, we were frightened of gas then, of course, still. And I remember you used to put out gas indicators, you know, a little bit of paper on the end of a cleft stick, which would change colour if there was any gas, mustard gas or chlorine. I think they were the only ones we knew in those days. And the soldiers wore their anti-gas capes, or not capes, well, they were right down the whole of their bodies. They were sort of... they were anti-gas. They were more like a tarpaulin, but much more flexible. And then when they weren't being used, they were rolled up and put at the back above the haversack. But they used to patrol both sides of the train, two together, one walking behind the other on each side.
How long would they be on for?
2 hours.
2 hours.
I'm sure of that, yes. I mean, I don't remember, but you can't expect.
Was that day and night, so 24 hours?
Oh, yes. Yes, day and night.
I mean, was there any attempt to approach the train or interfere with it?
No, we had none at all. But obviously, we were guarding it, so we had to keep guards on during the day as well.
Who relieved you then when you eventually
Nobody.
Went off?
Oh. What happened? One night I had to... a soldier was sick. So I hired the old taxi again and took this guy off to a hospital, which was a French hospital, the nearest one I could get him to. And I was up most of the night. And then in the morning, I went, lay down on my passenger seat in my compartment, went to sleep. Next thing I knew, a soldier was waking me up and says, "The general outside." So I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yes, he wants to see you, sir." So I said, "Oh, right." So I don't think I'd ever looked so terrible all my life, which disappointed me a bit. My hair was on end. I got off the thing, put my boots on without doing the laces up. I got out of the compartment, and there was the adjutant general standing outside. we had taken a lot of pains to keep ourselves well turned out all the time I was there, and I was a little bit shocked at finding myself in front of a general like this. Anyway, I explained it to him, and he seemed very sympathetic. But he, you know, after having a conversation with me, he went off and said, "Right, this has got to end." And soon after he disappeared, I got orders to take the train back to Brest again.
All the way back.
Well, we didn't actually finish up in Brest. We took it to somewhere, I can't remember where it was, where we all got out. And we were, for the last sector from there to Brest, we were put into cattle trucks. You know, the old sort of 40 men or 8 horses, Huitom or Carant Cheveux. We got into those with straw on the ground, and of course we looked down our noses at this sort of thing we were used to. So we finished up our 2 months in those, going back to Brest.
Who actually, how did you get the order?
I can't remember.
Or telephone?
I can't remember. I simply cannot remember. I suppose probably an officer came down and told us. And then it was a question of giving orders to the French railways to hook us onto a train somewhere or give us an engine and start the trek back. We had one mishap on the way back, I remember. I just happened to be looking out of the carriage window forward, because we were at the back of the train, and the engine up front was chuffing away. And I suddenly saw one of these, I don't know how it happened, one of the wagons with the ammunition rose up and parked itself on the buffers of the wagon in front. And I couldn't stop the train. Mind you, there's all ammunition in these wagons. And I couldn't do anything about it. And I had to keep watching it all the time till we got somewhere. I can't remember how it was resolved or how it ever got up there. But eventually we finished up in Brest, where there was some first line reinforcements was based. So we joined first line reinforcements of the regiment. And it wasn't long. I was about 3 or 4 days, I suppose, and I was called up to go back to the battalion.
Where were the battalion when you were joining?
They were up with the BEF. The only thing I can remember is a place called Gauchon-Lagalle in northern France. And they were part of, I think they were part of two corps at that time. They were corps troops. They were later become part of 25 Brigade in 50 Div with two other regular battalions.
Can you remember what the battalion was actually doing when you rejoined them, and what they gave you to do?
Well, at that time, the BEF was working on defences along the Belgian border. As you know, the Maginot Line came up to the corner of the Belgian border, and there was nothing along the Belgian border at all. And because the Belgians would never allow anybody to go there and talk to them beforehand, and scared of upsetting the Germans, I think, we then set about building defences there. I remember very well, it was pouring with rain a lot of the time, and people were wading around in mud and water, building ditches, anti-tank ditches. The sappers were building pillboxes there as well. And that lasted until the end of the year, really. And then early in 1940...
Can I just ask you a bit about the ditches you were...
Yes, of course,
building? How deep and how wide were they, approximately?
I wish I could remember. We built them really in conjunction with the water, the rivers and so forth that were there, so that they were pretty wide and pretty deep, too. But, of course, we never stayed to use them.
How was the work done? Was it done with hand tools, or did you have anything more sophisticated to make the excavations?
No, we were mostly all done by shovel and muscle, actually. At the end of each day, everybody was covered in mud and soaking wet.
And what was the soil and the terrain like in that area where you were digging the ditches?
As far as I remember, I mean, it was very, very muddy indeed. So it was typical sort of First World War sort of... I suppose we had duck boards there as well that they used to have. But it was very sloppy sort of terrain under the rain when it got wet.
Do you remember if there were anti-tank positions sited to cover the ditch?
I don't remember. In any case, I don't think we had much in the way. We had 2-pounders in those days, which were completely useless. So even if we had anti-tank positions, I don't think they'd have done any good. And the same with the tanks, of course. Those little tanks we had, they were irrelevant.
Did you see any of those?
No. No, I don't remember seeing any. I know that I was told afterwards only half of them only had machine guns anyway, and the others had 2-pounders, I believe. Nothing to stand up to the German.
How did your men take to this endless labour in the
Well, they took to it very well, actually. They were I think, as I mentioned before, these were all pre-war regular soldiers who were used to toughing it out in India and places like that, and they just took it in their stride. I don't remember any problems with discipline or morale at all.
Were you with the same platoon that you'd been with when you were guarding the ammunition train?
No. When I went back to the battalion, I went into B Company. Previously, I'd been with D.
Yes.
Under Major Horace Hull, it was. He was an old West African. He served in West Africa and had recurrences of malaria, I remember. And this one was commanded by Captain Paul Painter. B Company I went to, yes, I had a platoon there.
How long did it take you to sort of get au fait and on a good basis with those chaps when you turned up?
I don't think very long. I mean, I've been serving with the same sort of people before. They were incredible. I mean, I was 20 at that time. And most of them were in their late 20s or early 30s. And I think they took it upon themselves to look after me, you know. And but at the end of the day, they realised that they depended on me to look after them. So it was a sort of mutual mutual benefits.
Sounds like a social contract.
Yes, it almost was, yes. But they were terrific chaps, you know.
What ways did they look after you?
Well, they'd always do things for you, you know, that you didn't necessarily have to be done. And they'd ask you if you wanted this done, all that done, and if you happened to make any mistakes, they'd cover up for you.
And what was it that you did for them that they wanted you to...
Well, hopefully leadership. Hopefully. And look after them in their problems, their family problems, or their own personal problems, which I could take up with higher authority. And if you've got their confidence, they'd always come and talk to you and tell you what worried them or something. You could usually tell anyway if you got them in amongst them.
What were their origins? Were these men Essex men, or were they Londoners?
There's a mixture of both. A lot of them came from East London because, you know, there was a lot of unemployment before the war. We did have some from Essex, from out in the country, and they blended in very well together. But mostly the senior NCOs and WOs and so forth were from... They were sharper witted, I think. And they were from the East End of London.
Was your platoon sergeant an East Ender? Do you remember?
I can't remember the one there. Certainly the one I had before, who was with me on the train, Sergeant Darkey Ward, he was. I don't know why wards were all called Darkey, but they were. Now, he was from the East End of London, yes. And he was a champion boxer in the army. But I really can't remember who my platoon sergeant was when I got back to the battalion.
When you were engaged in this labouring work, where were you living?
We were living in billets. After the rains of 1939, we got into an ice age almost in early 1940. And I remember we were taken off the work on... We were doing roads as well, which I didn't mention. We were also doing patching up roads with the help of the sappers who came along with the sort of rolling gear and stuff, which were going to be the lines of communication for the BEF. Whether they were going to use them before the balloon went up or whether it was after the balloon went up, I don't know. But we spent a lot of time out there. And that was early in 1940. Well, we were taken off this with the idea of doing some training. But the roads were so icy and it was so cold that they couldn't move trucks and vehicles around very easily, so they put us back on the roads again.
Were you able to do any sort of training, individual or platoon training?
Well, we did a lot of marching. I remember marching down these long, straight, cobbled roads with poplar trees on either side that seemed to disappear over the horizon, which are well known to all soldiers, I think, who served in northern France, both wars. And there were ranges. We used to go on the ranges sometimes. And then there was individual training, you know, weapon training, field craft and that sort of thing. And there were courses that were run, because I remember there was one on mines where we sent an officer and he got blown up, poor chap. I think he was blinded, as far as I can remember. There were a junior leaders course I went on there from letters. I got letters which my father kept, which I wrote at the time. But that's just, I didn't even remember I'd been on the course until I read it in the letter. So I'm afraid I can't tell you about it.
What conditions like in the billets?
Well, the billets, the one I remember most vividly is a sort of a small cottage. And of course they had no heating in those, no central heating of any sort. I suppose they had one room where they had a fire and a kitchen, I suppose. And the bedroom was absolutely ice cold, and I'm not sure that I didn't go to bed in my full kit on occasions. I certainly piled up everything I could on top of me to keep warm during the night. It really was quite icy. But we were in sort of civilian billets. But we did have one place from Gershon Lagal. I think we moved to a place called Mershin, which was on the La Bassée Canal. And there we had problems with the local civilians. Mostly, I think, they were quite friendly. But for some reason or other, they were the closed doors. You know, they didn't really want to welcome us. I don't know whether we'd had soldiers there in the First World War who misbehaved. Certainly, football hooligans were 40 years away. And we had to do quite a lot to gain their confidence. We sort of beat retreat with the drums, which we had with us. We had cocktail parties, which we invited the mayor and the dignitaries of the villages, of the town. And we used to march through there to go to drumhead service on Sunday and put a little show on. And finally, we sort of gradually thawed them out and won them over. And when they began to realize that we weren't really there to rape their daughters or start trouble, they took us in. But I think it's something to do with their feeling of not another war after the first one, you know. Because being in northern France, they'd all suffered very badly from the first lot. And the older ones probably didn't relish the second one. I didn't blame them either.
Were the people in this area, do you remember, were they French-speaking or Flemish-speaking?
Oh, they were, well, the ones I spoke to were French. I couldn't have communicated in Flemish, and I have great difficulty. In French, actually, if I just tell you a short story, one of my least successful attempts at speaking French, I went, for some reason or other, I went into an estaminet on my own. I don't know what I was doing in there, but I remember this, and I asked for a piano. And they both looked at me in absolute astonishment. And I said, piano, piano, you know. And then the chap behind the bar was the manager, sort of, I know. He beckoned me to follow him up two flights of stairs into a storeroom up there, opened the door, went over the corner and whipped a sheet off a piano and said, voila! So since then, I've never asked for a piano anyway, because I'm not really interested in pianos anyway. So that's the only occasion I think I can remember. I used to speak French locally with them in a very limited way, but the soldiers managed to get past, you know, by their gesticulating, and they pick up the odd word here and there. They probably got themselves more understood more easily than I did.
But were they also in billets?
I wish I could remember. They must have been. I think I don't think the whole battalion could have been put into billets, because that would, I mean, we were on war establishment then, which was not short of 1,000. I mean, it was over 900. So I imagine that they must have been in sort of halls and village halls and old factories and things like that. I mean, in Brest we found ourselves in an old wine storage place down there.
When you were engaged in this digging work and so forth at Gershon-Lagal and National, did you have defensive positions planned or prepared, as well as doing the labouring?
We personally didn't know. We were there just as labourers, but assumed